Hi, everyone. On November 15th, 1937, a cartoonist named Al Capp published a comic strip that took on a life of its own. I mean, he never realized that this one comic strip would lead to an annual event in towns across the United States. In this particular installment of Little Abner, a prominent resident of the town of Dogpatch named Hexabiah Hawkins was worried that his homely-looking but speedy daughter, Sadie, would wind up an unmarried old spinster. And so he created an event where all of the town's bachelors would line up, they would wait for the starting gun and run for their lives while all the bachelorettes would line up and chase after them. Now, this was the genesis of what people came to call Sadie Hawkins Day. Now, it seems silly to us in our modern day, but it was a day each year where women would initiate asking men out for a date or for a dance. And so in the mid-20th century, it was still rare for the women to be the aggressor in a relationship. And if it was rare in the 1950s in America, in the ancient world of the Old Testament, it was completely unheard of. But that's what's going to happen in our story today. And so keep Sadie Hawkins in your mind as we go along in this message today. Now, I want to thank Pastors Mark Driscoll and Larry Osborne and Tim Keller and Chris Brown for some of their great insights in today's message. Well, we're going to be in Ruth chapter 3, and so you can turn there now and get ready to take some notes. And I want to give you a quick recap as you're getting there. There's this small family, a husband, a wife, and two boys who lived in Bethlehem under the hand of God. But a famine came to their land, and people were supposed to repent of their sins and turn back to God. But instead, this family ran away from God, essentially abandoned God, and they ran to a place called Moab, which was filled with sinful and rebellious God-haters. And in Moab, this family started to experience the consequences of running from God. The husband dies, both sons die, leaving Naomi, the wife and mother, alone in a foreign and pagan country with two pagan daughters-in-law and a deep sense of bitterness against God. You see, when all the men in her life died, she didn't just lose them, she lost her future. Because in those days, men were the key to long-term security and lands and income and inheritances, kind of a built-in social security system. But as a widow, she would have nothing. She couldn't own property. She couldn't work. She was too old to remarry. She would be at the very bottom of the societal totem pole with no options left. And so she decides to return home to Bethlehem, to her God, to her people. But in the process, she urges her Moabite daughters to stay in their homes, stay in Moab, return to their families, get remarried, have a good life. Naomi wanted to protect her daughters, you see, from her own misery. But in a moment of incredible faith and loyalty, one of the daughters, named Ruth, says, "No, I'm coming with you. Even though I'm going to be an unwanted immigrant from a hated people group, I'm coming with you. I want your God to be my God." And it's an amazing step of faith. And so Naomi and Ruth, these two very vulnerable women, return to Bethlehem in a helpless and hopeless situation. But last week, we saw that God's invisible hand was guiding their steps. Ruth went out to glean from the fields to find food for the two of them. And a series of so-called coincidences transpired. She just so happened to go to a field owned by a man named Boaz, who happened to be a relative of theirs, a very important detail, who happened to take notice of Ruth and kindly acted toward her. He happened to protect her. He happened to give her extra food and share with Naomi. And even though Naomi had become a bitter old woman, God is beginning to show his love and faithfulness to these two vulnerable ladies, mainly through this powerful and shrewd businessman named Boaz. In fact, I mentioned last week more than a few times that Boaz's relationship with this family is a very critical detail. He was a relative of Naomi's husband, and here's why that's so important. I want you to look at the end of chapter 2, verse 20, and then the beginning of chapter 3. It says, "Naomi said to her, 'The man is a close relative of ours, one of our redeemers.'" Now, look at chapter 3, verse 1. "Then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, 'My daughter, shall I not seek security for you, that it may be well with you? Now is not Boaz our kinsman?'" Now, before we go any further, and we're about to see one of the craziest pickup moves in all of history, okay, I promise you. But I want to talk about this idea of a kinsman redeemer for just a moment, okay? Boaz is a kinsman redeemer for Naomi. The Hebrew word is Goel. He's her Goel, a kinsman by blood. Now, I want you to underline that word kinsman in 3:2 and just write redeemer. and a reference in the margin, Leviticus 25. Now, I want to talk about how this works for a moment. In Leviticus 25, the Jewish law made a provision where a blood relative was allowed to buy back or redeem the property or family members who had been lost. Okay, and so when Israel came into the promised land under Joshua, okay, all of the land was divided up in between families. It's kind of like the Wild Wild West in America. And God knew some of those families, when they received their property, they would fall into poverty, or they would make bad decisions along the way and lose their land. And so he made two very interesting provisions that would make it easy for families to get a second chance, to get their land back. He didn't want this society to become characterized by huge divergences between rich and poor. This was a theocracy, after all. And so the first provision was this, that every 50 years, it was called a Jubilee year, where all the land, no matter how many times it had changed hands, would all go back to the original family who owned it. It's a pretty radical idea. But even before the 50 years was up, the land could be redeemed by a kinsman. It could be bought back, but only by a family member, a blood relative, a next of kin. This was a way of making sure that land stayed in that family and that people who fell on hard times were cared for. It was God's gracious love for families. Now, similarly, if a husband died, the next of kin is given the opportunity to marry that widow. Again, it sounds a little weird to us, but he would have to pledge to purchase all of the property of that dead husband and then to marry the widow. And if they had a baby together, here's the thing, the widow and that new child would then own that property. Now, it sounds weird to our ears, but I'll remind you that the worst situation in the ancient world was to be a widow without sons and without property. And so the kinsman redeemer was the solution. It was God's way of keeping families together and making sure that they had future security. Now, there were three qualifications for kinsman redeemers. First, you had to be, number one, a blood relative. Second, you had to be qualified. In other words, you needed enough money and wherewithal to buy that property back and to marry the widow. And third, you had to be willing. This is most important. I mean, if you were a kinsman, you weren't required to marry the widow. This was purely optional. So you had to be willing. So when we read that Boaz was a kinsman redeemer for Naomi and Ruth, we know that he's already met the first two qualifications just by reading the story. He's a relative and he's qualified. He's wealthy. But the question is, would he be willing? And so we're left on the edge of our seats. What will Boaz do? We're going to see a couple of roadblocks that come into the story. I mean, the redemption that Boaz will have to do is enormous. There are not only one, but two women, an extensive property. And so the personal cost to Boaz is going to be huge. But we'll also find out in a moment that Boaz is not the first kinsman in line. He's not even the closest relative. And the third issue in this case, for the land and family to truly be redeemed, Boaz was going to have to marry the last remaining family member, which in this case would be Naomi, and raise some children with her. The problem is Naomi's too old to have children. So there's this provision in the law that Moab could marry Ruth and provide a child as an inheritance for this family. But as we said in week one, the issue with that is Deuteronomy 23 forbids any Moabite from entering the assembly of the Lord. The whole thing has just become a real long shot. Plus, Boaz doesn't seem to be interested in Ruth. Now, for 6 or 7 weeks, Ruth has been showing up to work in the fields. And Boaz hasn't made a next move. And time is running out because the harvest is coming to an end. There'll be no more gleaning. And so after this initial connection that they seem to have, Boaz has done nothing. No follow-ups, no second date, no text messages, no coffee, no dinner, no Snapchat, nothing. The man just has no game, okay? And so once Ruth and Naomi have put it together that Boaz is a kinsman redeemer for them, they decide to go all Sadie Hawkins on this dude, okay? So I want you to look at the second half of verse 2. This is Naomi talking now. Behold, he, Boaz, he winnows barley at the threshing floor tonight. Wash yourself, Ruth, therefore. Go anoint yourself. Put on your best clothes. Go down to the threshing floor. But do not make yourself known to the man until he's finished eating and drinking. It shall be when he lies down, and you shall notice the place where he lies. You shall go and uncover his feet and lie down. And then he will tell you what you shall do. She, Ruth, said to her, Naomi, all that you say, I will do. And so she went down to the threshing floor, and she did according to all that her mother-in-law had commanded her. And when Boaz had eaten and drunk, and his heart was merry, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain, and she came secretly and uncovered his feet and lay down. Now, here's why we really teach this story in junior high youth group, okay? What in the world is going on here? I mean, Naomi's a dirty old bird, huh? I mean, we're going to title this little section, How to Catch a Husband, okay? Naomi tells Ruth this. She says, shall I not seek rest for you? You can underline that little verse and just write, find a husband in the margin. That's what's happening. Modern translation here is, girl, we need to find you a man, okay? And so the bitter old woman, Naomi, suddenly goes all eHarmony here. She hatches a sneaky little plan for Ruth to snag Boaz. We talked last week how attractive Ruth's character was. Well, this week, ladies, we see that it's also important to look and smell good, okay? Naomi tells her daughter-in-law to pretty herself up. She's like, hey, we need to get you to a tanning appointment, you know, sun your buns or whatever. We need to get your hair foiled. We'll do a mani-pedi. We need to spray some of the Moabite madness all over your fine self, and you're going to go visit Boaz, okay? He's going to be sleeping on the threshing floor overnight, guarding the barley harvest from thieves. I want you to wait till he has some wings in him, a few beers in him, okay? He's going to be happy. You're going to sneak in after he's fallen asleep, and you're going to go uncover his feet, wink, wink, okay? Some commentators suggest that this means exactly what it says it means. Others think that it means she's supposed to uncover a little bit more of Boaz, okay? But regardless of the suggestion, as the scene plays out, both of these people, this man and this woman, are going to show incredible character and restraint in this moment. Nothing sexual is going on here. Now, the normal way to go about kind of finding a husband was to have your dad talk to your future husband. Remember, Ruth didn't have a dad. She left her family behind in Moab. And so, Sadie Hawkins we go. All right, so look at verse 8. We're going to title this little section, What Happens on the Threshing Floor Stays on the Threshing Floor. All right, look at verse 8. It happened in the middle of the night that the man was startled and bent forward, and behold, a woman was lying at his feet. Yeah, that would startle you. He said, who are you? And she answered, I'm Ruth, your maid. So spread your covering over your maid, for you are a close relative. And then he said, may you be blessed of the Lord, my daughter. You have shown your last kindness to be better than the first by not going after young men, whether poor or rich. Now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you whatever you ask, for all my people in the city know that you are a woman of excellence. All right, so Ruth sneaks over. She uncovers Boaz's feet. She lies down. He's startled and he wakes up. She asks him to spread his cloak over her. In other words, if he likes it, he should put a ring on it, okay? So in verse 9, I want you to underline that phrase. Spread your covering over your maid, and just write marriage proposal in the margin. She's telling him in this moment, I love you. I want to marry you. I want to be with you. I want to climb into your bed as your wife. And we could make babies and it would be great. And Boaz responds essentially, you know, thank you, Jesus. He promises her. He said, I would love to marry you, but I'm surprised you went for me. He's not that great looking, ladies, okay? He's kind of older, but he has a job. Write that down. You know, single guys, jobs are good when it comes to attracting a lady. Good jobs are really good. But Ruth is just crushing a bunch of cultural taboos here. A woman is asking a man. A Moabite is asking a Hebrew. A younger person is asking an older person. An employee is asking her boss. She's very bold. She takes great risk here, but listen, both of them in this moment are acting with impeccable character. And so Boaz, yes, is interested in this woman, but he's extremely honorable. I mean, this scene could have gone a bunch of different directions. Can we agree on that? Based on Boaz's moral compass. He's, first of all, a little tipsy. He's got a beautiful young woman laying at his feet. He smells that perfume, okay? And what does he do? First thing he does, he prays for her. It's right there in verse 10. He says, may you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter. In fact, I'd love for you to underline that. If this thing had any chance of going in the wrong direction right now in this bed, Boaz hits the brakes. You can just write resist temptation with prayer in the margin. It's a great example for us. Now, not only does he show character, but in the next verse, he references her character. She too, he says, is a woman of excellence. And so even though they're from different sides of the tracks, they're equally yoked before God as a godly man and a godly woman. Now I want you to look at verse 12. We're going to name this section, Meet Bachelor Number 2, okay? Verse 12. Now it's true, I'm a close relative. However, there is a relative closer than I. Remain this night, and when morning comes, if he will redeem you, good. Let him redeem you. But if he does not wish to redeem you, then I will redeem you as the Lord lives. And so here's the snag in Naomi's plan. Boaz reveals a heartbreaking piece of information. He says that he's a relative, all right, but he's not the closest relative to Naomi's late husband, Elimelech. There's another guy running around town who has more of a claim to her than he does. So scoot over to chapter 4, verse 1. We'll continue the story. So now Boaz has gone up to the gate, and he sat down there, and behold, the Redeemer of whom Boaz had spoken came by. So Boaz has said, turn aside, friend, sit down here. And he turned aside, and he sat down. So Boaz is going to be really shrewd here, okay? He knows that he has to give first right of refusal to another guy. And so he goes into town, he sits down at the place where business is conducted, and legal matters are transacted. And it just so happens that here's this invisible hand of God again. Look at verse chapter 4, 1. It says, behold, the Redeemer of whom Boaz had spoken came by. You can underline that word behold and just write God's providence once again. God decided to bring along Mr. What's-His-Face at just the right time. And Boaz says, hey, what's up, friend? We never even learned this guy's name. We can surmise that he's a loser, okay? He was biblically obligated as the closest relative to Naomi and Ruth to at least check in on them, to make sure that they're okay. This guy's been nowhere to be found. The women are starving to death, and he doesn't even look in on them. Boaz doesn't even know his name, but he does what guys do. Any guys relate to this? He says, hey, friend, right? Guys, you ever not know somebody's name? You're like, hey, man, you know, what's up, bro? Hey, dude. Right? So Boaz says, hey, friend, come take a seat next to me. And he grabs 10 elders from the city so that he could have some legal witnesses, and he begins his shrewd negotiation. He's very clever. He says, hey, Mr. What's-His-Face, there's some land that you have the rights to. They belonged to your relative, Elimelech. You want some more property, bro? Right? You're the first in line to redeem it. And so if you want it, just say so in front of me and these 10 witnesses, and it's yours. But if you don't want it, I'm next in line, and I will gladly redeem it myself. And Mr. What's-His-Face says, yeah, sure. Of course I want some more property. Boaz says, perfect. Sold. Oh, by the way, before we ink this deal, you probably ought to know a little detail. Look at verse 5. The day you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you also acquire Ruth the Moabite, the widow of the dead, in order to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance. He's like, did I mention that the land comes with a bitter old mother-in-law? I mean, imagine yourself on some Sunday afternoon going house shopping to various open houses, and you walk into a house and you fall in love with it. It's the perfect house. And at the end of your little tour, the realtor stands in the kitchen with you and says, oh, there's one more thing. In the bedroom upstairs, there's a bitter old woman. She comes with the house. You'd be like, listen, I think we're good. You know, we're going to keep looking, whatever. That's what Boaz does. He practically inks the deal, and then he says, oh, an old woman comes with the property. She refers to herself as bitter old hag, okay? And then he throws in, oh, yeah, did I mention there's also a Moabite woman that comes with the property, too? You know those Moabites. And she's the one you're going to have babies with. Oh, yeah, and she was previously married. So, you know, what do you think? Still interested? And Mr. What's-His-Face is like, whoa, 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 whoa. Hey, yeah, you know, I think I'm good just sticking with my current setup. I mean, I'd be up for some additional acreage, but the additional women I can do without, you know, more women, more problems. And Boaz is like, okay, if you insist, I'll step up and do the right thing. I'll take the property and redeem the women myself. And so they complete the legal transaction by taking off their sandals. Don't ask questions. That's just how they did it in those days. And so Boaz guarantees that Naomi, listen now, guys, that Naomi, who had returned to her homeland in absolute poverty, who had faced starvation, who had faced certain death, that Naomi is granted all the rights and privileges, all the inheritances, all that come from this kinsman redeemer. Everything that is his now becomes hers. Listen, she did nothing to earn it at all. But suddenly she's the proud owner of lands and fields and houses and estates because she and Ruth were redeemed by their kinsman redeemer. It's a powerful story. And we read a story like this, and our tendency is to see ourselves in one of the characters. Some of you have seen some of yourself in Ruth maybe along the way, scrappy, hardworking, taking initiative. Others have strived to be more like Boaz, godly, honorable, kind, generous. May I suggest that the person in this story that we're supposed to relate to the most is Naomi. Now, I know I'm late in my message today to share the big idea with you, but here it is. Today's big idea is this. Like Naomi, we need a redeemer. The character most like us is Naomi. We hear a story like this, and our tendency is to try to draw some moral lessons out of it and to walk away saying, well, you know, I just need to be a better person. And yes, that's true. But before we finish this story, I want to take you over to the New Testament because I think it's going to shed some light on who we're supposed to relate to. We're going to go over to Luke chapter 24, starting in verse 13. It's a profound story that of two men who were on their road to Emmaus. They were followers of Jesus. They had been in Jerusalem when Jesus was crucified. They were pretty shaken up about it. It was 3 days after his death, and they were making their way on their 7-mile walk back home to Emmaus. And they were processing all the tragedy of these last 3 days. And in the middle of their conversation, the resurrected Jesus starts walking with them, but they didn't recognize him. And he comes up kind of acting all, you know, dumb. He said, oh, hey, what are you guys talking about? And they say, have you been living under a rock? Haven't you heard what happened to this man named Jesus? And they say this in verse 21 of Luke 24. They say, we had hoped that he was the one to redeem Israel. There's that word. We had hoped that he was our redeemer. We thought he was the answer, that he was going to buy back his people, but instead he was killed. And Jesus proceeded with these two men to do a little Bible study. Now, I've been in a lot of Bible studies before, but can you imagine being in Jesus' Bible study? And here's how Luke describes it in verse 27. It says, and beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he interpreted to them in all the scriptures the things concerning himself. So Jesus turns to Moses and the prophets. That's just shorthand for the Old Testament. And he walks these two guys through the Old Testament and explains how every page of the Old Testament is pointing to him. It all foreshadows him. There's a type of Jesus presented throughout the pages of the Old Testament. Where's our story today, the story of Ruth? It's in the Old Testament. And I point you to this passage to remind you that the story of Ruth isn't just a nice story about being moral and doing the right things. No, it shouts to us across the pages of history that a true redeemer, Jesus, has rescued us, that we are Naomi. Think about it. Think about the similarities. We all have walked away from God in our sin like Naomi did, abandoning him to seek a better life in Moab. We have been hopeless, even bitter against God. We have found ourselves completely out of options before, unsatisfied, in desperate need of a redeemer. We are Naomi. And the saying goes that Jesus didn't come to make bad people good. He came to make dead people alive. And guys, without a redeemer, we're dead. You think about this story, and it's hinted at in every chapter that without Boaz, Ruth would have died. She would have gone out gleaning, and if Boaz hadn't protected her, she probably would have been murdered. And if that had happened, Naomi surely would have died without any food. You see, without the kinsman redeemer, there was no hope that Naomi would survive this story. And without Jesus, guys, there is no hope that any of us could truly live. Some of you understand the emptiness of life away from God, the guilt and shame that piles up, the consequences that accumulate, the cheap thrills that promise to bring satisfaction but only leave you feeling emptier the next day, the chasing after fame, the chasing after fortune in your own strength, and it proves to be a meaningless pursuit. We need a new life. We need a new start. We need a second chance. We need a redeemer. And Ruth chapter 3 points us to the truth that Jesus is our true kinsman redeemer. At the beginning of my message today, I said that there were three qualifications for a kinsman redeemer. He needed to be a blood relative, a kin. He needed to be qualified, and he needed to be willing to redeem. Let's marvel at Jesus for a moment and how he meets each qualification. Jesus became our kin. Jesus became our kinsman. He left his throne and all the glories of heaven so that he could welcome and relate to the immigrant, to us who have wandered far, the strangers and the aliens of this world. He became one of us. John 1 says that the Word became flesh and dwelt for a little while among us. He took on flesh. Philippians 2 says that even though Jesus was one with God, that he did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but he emptied himself by taking the form of a servant, being born, listen, in the likeness of men. Jesus would take on flesh and blood so that he could redeem us. He became our kinsman. Second, he was qualified to pay the price. You know, Boaz redeemed with silver and gold, but the cost of our souls is far greater, more than money could ever buy. And so Jesus paid the price with his life, with his own blood. If a mere human had tried to give his life for us, it wouldn't have been enough. But God himself gave his life. Listen to the way Peter describes it. He says, you were ransomed, you were redeemed from the futile ways inherited from your forefathers, not with perishable things, such as silver and gold. That's not how you were redeemed. You were redeemed with the precious blood of Christ. He's redeemed us with his own perfect life. And so he became our kinsman. He was qualified to pay the price. But third, and most importantly, he was willing to redeem us. All of these other qualifications don't matter if Jesus hadn't been willing to rescue us. This is the most amazing truth of all. Jesus says in John 10:18, no one takes my life from me, but I lay it down willingly of my own accord. And so he sacrificed his life for us willingly because of his love for us. God so loved the world. He loved the world so much that he gave his only son. God looked at Jesus and he looked at you and he chose you. This kind of love should bring us to our knees in worship and surrender. Because now, all he has becomes ours. This is the amazing outcome. Like a true kinsman redeemer, Boaz didn't just take on the property debt of Naomi's family, but by marrying Ruth, they became one family. And the minute he married her, everything that was his was now hers. In other words, the debts weren't just canceled, but a whole new life was offered. And guys, the same is true of us with our kinsman redeemer. The work of Christ did much more than merely provide a fire insurance claim from hell. He set you apart. He sanctified you. He made you a part of his people, the family of God. And now everything that is his becomes yours. That's why the Bible says that we are joint heirs with Jesus Christ. And some of you are here today and you didn't know it walking in, but the new life that Christ offers is your greatest need today. You may have walked in thinking your greatest need was healing in your marriage or more patience at work or a financial windfall of some kind, or maybe even just to hear an inspirational message today. But in truth, your greatest need is Jesus. And I have good news for you today. He's available to you. You know, in this story, we've seen God showing up again and again as people obey him. Starting with Ruth, who said at the beginning of our story, you know, nothing but death will keep me from doing what I ought to do, from following God. She knows that if the Lord is truly the Lord, that she can put no conditions on her obedience. A lot of us put conditions on our obedience of God. We say, God, I'll follow you, you know, as long as you help me accomplish my goals. We say, God, I'll ask you into my life because I need help fulfilling my dreams. And so the thing that becomes sovereign is not God, but it's your agenda. You want God in your life, but you want to be the master and you want God to be the servant. And God looks back at us and God says, I don't come into your life to reach your goals, but I'll let you into my life so that you can reach my goals. Because see, as soon as you say, I'll follow you if, on the other side of that if is your true God. And you're just going to try to use the God of the Bible to get to that thing. And Ruth and Naomi and Boaz, they show us that you have to go into a relationship with God without assuming that you're going to have the perfect little life. But we have to just say, you know what? I'm taking all the conditions off my obedience. I'm going to follow you no matter what. And so the temptation today is to learn some nice lessons from the book of Ruth and to say, oh good, I'm going to go out and do all these things. I'm going to try really hard to be a better person, when actually we should be left saying, I can't do this by myself. I can't follow unconditionally. I'm weak and imperfect. I'm sometimes bitter. I need someone to help me. I need a redeemer. Because when we hit that place, we're in the perfect place. You see, we are Naomi. And for us, the real redeemer will be born in Bethlehem, that same little town, over a millennium later. The author's trying to point us to a great descendant who is coming, but who looks a lot like his ancient father and mother, Boaz and Ruth. And like Boaz, he not only paid your debt, but all his wealth becomes yours. He became our kinsman. He went outside the gate. He became truly an immigrant. And it doesn't matter who you are, what you've done today, what kind of failure you think you are, the message here is a message of grace. Jesus isn't just a purchaser of distressed property. He's the one who purchases, at the cost of his own blood, lives and souls in need of a redeemer. And there's never been a soul so distressed that Jesus didn't want to buy it back. There's never been a life so complicated that Jesus didn't want to say, here, I'll take it. I'll rescue it. Come to me. No problem. I've paid for it. And now everything that is mine becomes yours. Some of you need to take all the conditions off your obedience today and surrender your lives to our one true Redeemer. Your host is going to come now and help us do just that. God bless you.